Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
And I'm Nicolas Potier.
And today we are discussing about the World Trade Organization, whether it has still a role to play, and what should be reformed to make it work. I'm very happy to host for this conversation Bernard Hochmann, who is professor and director of Global Economics at the Robert Schuman Center for Advanced Studies at the European University Institute in Florence, Petros Mavroidis, who is Edwin Parker Professor of Law at the Columbia Law School in New York, and Anna Diaz, lawyer and partner at Gide Loiret Null in Paris. Welcome to The Sound of Economics to all of you.
Happy to be here.
Very happy to be here too. Thank you, Giuseppe.
I'm the happiest to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think that I am even more happy to have all of you over there. This is a live recording session.
No, I am the happiest.
You are the happiest. Okay, perfect, Petros. We can establish that. This is a live recording session taking place on the Sound of Economic Club on Clubhouse. And as usual for our live recordings, we will have contribution from some of our listeners who have connected to join us in this conversation. But back to the topic. Bernard and Petros, you recently wrote together an article on the Revue Européenne de Droit about avoiding a requiem for the WTO. I found that you make a very good and condensed summary of what is at stake and what should be the main points to address for a possible reform of the organization. While the Biden administration has definitely signaled in many areas that the USA is back to play a game in multilateralism, trade remains still a core area of contention. And the tendency to the multiplication of bilateral or regional agreements does not seem to be stopping. Without even mentioning the tensions with China, even trade issues between the EU and the USA, whilst undergoing some settlement, they still don't have a clear-cut resolution. Before going into the details of your set of proposals about how the WTO could survive this convoluted era, I would like to ask both of you to kick off the conversation by providing your point of view about where do we stand in this very moment.
So where are we? I think, you know, you can either say the glass is half full or half empty. So it depends a bit on whether you're optimistically or pessimistically inclined. I think one of the things that has changed recently is that we're seeing some green shoots. We have a new director general at the WTO. She has a new team around her in in Geneva. There's also a new team in Washington, D.C., which I think is extremely important. As you've already mentioned, President Biden is much more inclined to be willing to engage multilaterally than the Trump administration was. We're seeing some movement, and in particular, the director general is really pushing to kind of get some immediate wins on the table. One of those she's pushing on is to get an agreement on fishery subsidies. There are ongoing plurilateral talks, which I'm sure we'll come back to, which I think are also very positive for the system. At least there is discussion now on new topics. I think on the less good side, we're still seeing the United States being quite hesitant to engage on trade policy and to prioritize trade in terms of their foreign policy. One of the problems, to my mind, is that the United States is obsessed with China. So therefore, everything is being seen through a China lens. And they still have the legacy of Trump actions taken against the European Union, against other countries, under the heading of protecting U.S. national security. So we have, you know, tariffs on steel exports from the European Union to the EU, which are still there. Obviously, we in Europe had hoped that that would be removed very quickly, or at the very least that the Biden administration would cease invoking national security as an argument for protecting particular industries. I think we're seeing, again, on the green shoot side, the deal that was announced today or yesterday on Boeing Airbus is a very good sign, but there's still a lot more to be done in terms of moving things forward. so that we can actually get back to where we were before Trump entered into office. Petros.
Bedankt. And Bernard gave, I think, a fantastic overview of where we are in terms of engagement by the big players, and especially the US. And if I were to sum it up in one sentence, I would say, well, the Biden administration at least does not obstruct the WTO anymore the way the previous administration did. But I want to say two words about the way the WTO functions against this background. The new DG, Mrs. Ngozi, in my view, I think Bernard got the point right away. He said she's looking for easy wins, early harvesting. I mean, this is how, for example, I was now all proportions guarded, of course. I was reading the last days the memoirs of Jean Monnet for the second time. This is exactly how he thought about the European integration. So forget the big picture. Let's start with small wins, and that's how we persuade people to go forward. And I think that's more or less her recipe. I hope it is a winning recipe, because quite frankly, the big issues lie ahead. We still are in the WTO with no dispute settlement, which is the only WTO, genuine WTO voice, and I see nothing happening there as we speak. And of course, there are the bigger questions, even bigger, the legislative crisis and so on and so forth. So I hope that her strategy to prioritize the low-hanging fruits will persuade people that they can go back to the multilateral table and address first the judiciary crisis, and then eventually see how they can make out of JSIs and variable geometry a permanent feature in WTO integration for the future. That's my 5 cents, if you wish.
Thank you so much, Petros. Anna, maybe you would like to add something to this picture.
Yes, sure. Thank you. So I just, again, agreeing with what both Bernard and Petro said on where we are, and on the sense that we also see that those issues being some more simple issues, if I can put it that way, are being solved and are on the table today at the WTO. So, of course, the WTO is still solving issues and continues to be quite operational on some negotiations. But those are not the most complicated issues. And as Joe, just to fully agree that on the really sensitive issues that put the WTO where it is, in a blockage status, notably as regards to dispute settlement, on that one, we see that the situation is a lot more complex. And we are seeing no real evolution, but just for the very simple reason that it is very complicated to put the US and China and in the middle, the EU, to agree on something that makes everyone happy. So one of the real questions, at least here, is how capable we will be in those blocks together or not will be able to change what is blocking the WTO on fundamental issues, or whether we will just leave with the WTO on fundamental issues on a little bit of a blockage stage and go on to live with it for now, where it can do a lot and continue to contribute, as it seems to be at least the first approach of the new DG.
Thank you. Niklas?
Yes, I would just want to pick up where Anna was left off. I think there are kind of fundamentally different visions for what the multilateral trade system could look like. We see in the EU that the EU on the one hand really supports having a kind of international system with a stringent dispute settlement system. It wants to expand the scope of trade policy to new areas like environmental policy, but also has a strong emphasis on things like labor rights. If we think, for instance, on the agreement with China. And this makes it difficult for the EU itself. But then we have a very completely different vision in the US, where the dispute settlement is really seen also as an impediment of their own sovereignty. We've all grown very tired of this notion of sovereignty over the Brexit negotiations, I suppose. But it's still very much at the heart of the question. It's the question, how much leverage do we give to a multinational body? How much do we constrain ourselves in our regulatory power, but also just in our discretionary power to react to other economies, to make power plays the way the US wants to do against China? And I think this really is the difficult problem to resolve here. And the issues that we now want to resolve at the WTO, and the growing parts of trade where these regulatory things were really in the heart of sovereignty for many states, are the things that are most important. If we think about trade, often most we think about tariffs, but that's not really the game in town. Especially when you think about services, it's a lot about regulation. And for instance, if we think about e-commerce, which is one topic where the WTO claims to make good advances, the most contentious issue are completely off the table. The EU is not willing to talk about free data flows for privacy reasons. China is not willing to constrain itself in localizing data in their own economy, basically for political control. And I think there's basically zero chance of this being resolved. And here, really, we have to find a common vision to what our system wants to look like. And maybe this will be much different role, and maybe a less smaller role than many of us in the international community and the European side would like to see.
Whether the political will exists to re-engage multilaterally and pursue WTO reform is actually quite an open question. But let's make a thought experiment, and let's pause it for a moment that such a political will would emerge, that such a common vision would be possible to imagine. Which would be the areas of reform that you would prioritize? And I look at Bernard and Petros because they've been writing about it in their article.
Our view was that judiciary, of course, it's super important and maybe a priority issue, but solving the judiciary is a necessary but definitely not a sufficient condition to solve the WTO problems. And why do we argue this way? Well, you see, let's assume that by magic wand, tomorrow you have a full functioning dispute settlement. So what kind of disputes will you see in the WTO? Well, disputes originating in agreements of the 20th century. But as we observe, and the work of the World Bank and our common friend Michele Ruta is remarkable in this respect, there have been dozens of free trade areas in the last 20 years, and the trade agenda has migrated to national capitals. Now, what really matters is not part of the WTO legislative framework. So unless we can revive the legislative function, resolving dispute settlement is just rearranging the furniture at the deck of the Titanic. I cannot be more blunt than that. Now, how do you do the legislative function? And we'll discuss dispute settlement later. In our view, we wrote this first paper in 2015, and I remember when I took this paper to a conference in Stanford, people were saying that we are in la-la land. Now, of course, more and more people see the argument and the merit in advancing variable geometry, the WTO. It cannot be otherwise. If what segments markets nowadays is behind the border instruments, the snags in Robert Baldwin's one of my heroes terminology, how on earth do you expect to rationalize the regulation of snags between players with totally asymmetric preferences? This is not six-digit tariffs anymore. So you have to, either you accept variable geometry within the WTO one way or the other, or you accept that the trade agenda will continue to migrate in free trade areas.
Yeah, let me just add to that. So I think if we think about what's needed, so how do you, I think the operational question is, and we've already started to go down this road, right? So there are ongoing negotiations among groups of WTO members with other WTO members who are not interested, not participating, right? So in that sense, this variable geometry track has already been taken. I think what is needed, and I think where reform, and I don't know to what extent you need reform, but you really need to have buy-in from the major players and a secretariat that is willing to actually support this process. Right, so I think one of the stylized facts of kind of engagement on trade policy tensions, conflicts, disputes, has been, like Petros said, on the one hand, countries have gone and taken the issue out of Geneva altogether, right, through negotiating trade agreements or engaging bilaterally with countries. But we haven't had really substantive discussions in Geneva that would actually help countries figure out
Is this a real issue? To what extent is this causing really serious spillovers for the trading system, as opposed to the issue really being a very narrow one that is of interest clearly to some industries, but at the end of the day doesn't really matter all that much for the system? And I think this preparatory work is really urgently needed. And that was done in the run-up to the Ergo round, the last big round. And we need that now today. And there's a lot of these issues that are confronting us with respect to climate change and what is the role of trade policy, state-owned enterprises and the behavior of firms that are essentially have access to support from the government who are operating internationally. Where is that a potential problem? How large is that problem? All of that requires analysis. And the same thing applies for some of the solutions. So it's really nice that some countries have gone off and negotiated rules in these different areas among like-minded countries, but that doesn't mean other countries are going to be willing to sign up to them. So we can't just say, oh, the EU has signed this wonderful agreement with Japan, which deals with state-owned enterprises, which deals with some of these sensitive issues. Why would China sign on to those disciplines? And I think the only way that is going to happen is if we actually have this preparatory process. And I think the WTO Secretariat has an important role to play there. The Secretariat has not been permitted to play that role. And the previous Director General was not inclined to actually help support a process where we have that deliberation ongoing. So I think one of the areas of reform where we need to start, I would argue, is we need to revitalize deliberation in the WTO through the committee structures that exist. And a necessary condition for that revitalization is that we do much more to bring in the private sector, that it's not just officials talking to each other. They need to hear from their constituencies that issues A, B, and C are really important, and issues X, Y, Z, which they're obsessing about, are really not all that important. They, you know, we can live with that. So I think that type of engagement has been missing. I think we need to really get that going, and I think that is an area where reform could focus on. Thanks.
Do you think that what you just mentioned could be a possible baby step, you know, like something that is feasible in terms of internal organization, like reforming the internal organization? You spoke about the secretariat and so on.
I think it shouldn't be that difficult to do. You know, there are quite a few people sitting there. I think, well, you know, I guess I will be quoted because this is on the record, but I think, you know, a fair number of those people are probably underemployed. So I think there is some slack in the system. So I think, yes, and we've seen it happen, right? So these joint statement initiative talks obviously come from somewhere. So I think what needs to be done is to encourage WTO members to put issues on the table, to ask the secretariat to do background work, but also to rope in other international organizations who have capacity and expertise in specific areas, because obviously the WTO Secretariat knows a lot about trade policy. But as was mentioned by Niklas, a big part of the agenda nowadays revolves around domestic regulation, which has international effects. And a lot of that is quite specialized, right? And we don't necessarily have the people with that expertise in the WTO, but we do have it in other international organizations. And we also have it, of course, in the academic environment. So I think bringing in that expertise is part of the solution. And it's something that WTO members have historically been hesitant to do. So I think that's where a little push is needed.
Thank you. And I was wondering, on the other side of the spectrum, you know, seen from a practitioner point of view, Anna, you have quite an experience on dealing on those issues in your daily work, you know. What is your perspective on that possible reform from the specifics of your observatory, which is quite different from, let's say, a policymaker perspective or a theoretical point of view or a more diplomacy negotiating kind of standpoint?
Yes. So, I mean, what I see in practice and a lot of what has been said falls into what I see in practice, because I think part of what Bernard just said is also linked to the fact that because the WTO rules are not fully adept and are today incomplete to deal with the realities that we are facing today, we need a lot more forums of discussions at the WTO, and there is a lot of potential for that. We have very little rules on services, digital economy. There are a number of things that are not yet very developed there, and there is a potential for that. On the other hand, what I see really on my daily life representing mainly EU companies that are facing those issues is that on the substantive and complex issues that we are blocked at the WTO, and a basic example, it's the subsidies issues, notably linked to Chinese governmental intervention. That part, we see that this is complex and that the rules being what they are today, it is creating a lot of problems. What the U.S. has voiced and led the crisis as it is, it's something that a lot of countries afterward, a lot of regions, including the EU, have agreed that there is a real issue here and we need reform. And the issue is that while we don't have reform, we are not being able sometimes, in whether it's in the US or in the EU, to have remedies to deal with situations that are quite urgent. So it is important, on the one hand, and I fully agree with Bernard and Petros, to create all these additional forums of discussions and leading to active debates that will lead ultimately to rules. But what we always see in the practice is that we also need short-term solutions. And we do see that it's not only the U.S. That comes always very fast with solutions, unilateral solutions, but now the EU is also building a set of what we call this toolbox with a lot of initiatives as to deal with the fact that this is blocked today. I need urgent solutions. So it is also recurring to, we don't call it unilateral, but autonomous measures as to deal with the difficulties today. So what we see is that, of course, it's always the ideal and we need all to target reaching the multilateral solution in every issue, even the more complex ones. But while we are not there, every country, and the EU is starting more and more, is trying to deal with it the way it can. And it's autonomous. It's not ideal, but it is what we can for now.
Thank you. Thank you, Anna. Niklas, do you want to add something on this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of problems. And you see that, I think what we talk now about is about building the building a basis for discussion, basically, building a forum, going back to kind of a conversation and including more players in the conversation. And I think this is maybe reflective, and Bernard and Petrus, tell me if you think this is, I misrepresent what you're saying. This is reflective of basically that we need a new discussion level, that we, at this point, we're kind of stuck. We're stuck for some years. And in a way, the situation has gotten worse over the years. And especially now with this kind of confrontation between the US and China, I think there's real risk here that this will be undermined further. Yes, of course, Joe Biden is someone that publicly is very pro-multilateral, but still there's this question, if this tension escalate further, at what point will this deteriorate the system further? And here, I think especially in Europe, we have to be careful in choosing our objectives. So the current EU trade strategy, or which is kind of developed at the moment, it has like two goals. One is saving the multilateral system, and the second one is advancing policy goals, environment, climate, human rights, labor rights. But there's kind of a tension. If we want to advance on all these issues, this, of course, will make some discussions more difficult. And I think here we might want to limit our expectations and really focus on the essentials. And that is really building a forum, making sure that kind of the services of the WTO, and in particular the jurisdiction, works again. And then we can think later about how we can basically build off all the other things we want in there, but maybe think more about other tools that we have to advance this kind of environmental issues, labor rights issues. Is trade policy really the right tool at this moment to do these things?
I'm actually coordinating a very large research project, the Horizon 2020 framework project, which actually deals exactly with this question. So essentially it assesses the EU strategy, and not just strategy, it's actually written into our treaties, that trade policy has to be used to promote European values, right? Labor, environment, human rights, what have you. But the treaty also says that trade policy is supposed to promote our interests, right? So we need to balance interests and values. And I don't think we've had an honest discussion in Europe as to how that should be done. And I think what we've seen with the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment kind of illustrates that we're not really on the same page in terms of how we do this. So one of the things I think in terms of WTO, where the WTO can help, is with some creative thinking, we can identify areas where we actually can separate these two things and should separate them. And if we don't separate them, then I think this is not just the system is going to go down, but it will be impossible for the European Union to actually negotiate trade agreements anymore. Right. So, and then we come into a world where, okay, fine. If you're a small developing country, you will agree to what the EU wants you to do, and you might not implement it. But if you're China, it's not going to happen. So part of what we do in this project is very interesting research by Jacques Beltmans and colleagues at CEPS on this, where they evaluate the alternative instruments that the EU has been using to promote these values. And pretty much the consensus among practitioners, but also the research shows that alternative instruments are much more effective at helping to improve these non-trade types of outcomes, achieve our non-trade objectives. And I think there's a real need for more communication, for more understanding, that if we're really serious about these values, we need to adopt and use different instruments than trade policy. Trade policy simply is not an effective instrument.
You somehow bring back one of the, or a couple of the elephants in the room over there. I mean, one is definitely the issue of China. I mean, we've been keeping repeating it since the beginning of the room, but we haven't yet zoomed in also because, you know, it would require a couple of rooms, if not more, in order to discuss about that. And the other issue that was touched upon very briefly, but not in depth, was the reform of the dispute settlement system. Both issues seems to be separate issues, but I see them also very interconnected, if I'm not mistaken, as a known expert on WTO issues. Perhaps we could zoom in a little bit more into this, at least to provide to our listeners an overview about where do we stand and what you and Petros are proposing over there.
On China, my view is expressed in a book we published this year with André Sapir. And in two sentences, the book says that if we take the complaints of the Western world at face value, largely, there is not much you can do within the WTO as the regime now is with respect to transfer of technology, which is by private agents, not by China. And to some extent also because of, in our view, errors by the appellate body in understanding how should you understand the legal disciplines of state trading enterprises and, of course, state-owned enterprises. Now, this is part of the story. The other part of the story is in the 90s, there was this exuberance, not just Fukuyama, everywhere, about the world coming together under the liberal order and so on. And people did not pay attention to the fine print and the details when negotiating the Protocol of Accession. I don't think the Protocol of Accession is the first best. And actually, the best proof for that is that when Obama came to power, he negotiated an agreement, the TPP, without China, for China. Now, he did it knowing that this is not what the Clinton administration, for example, had done in the 90s. That's on China. On dispute settlement, again, very briefly, in two sentences, I think the important thing in dispute settlement is to have compulsory third-party adjudication. This is what matters most. It's irrelevant if it is one or two instances. In my view, ideally one instance. For a number of reasons, ranging from speedy resolution of disputes to you name it. But these guys are agents with very substantial discretion. They have one incomplete contract, the WTO, which they have to interpret through another incomplete contract, the Vienna Convention. Who you appoint there matters. And in my view, this is something that the membership should take really seriously. I am very unhappy with the kind of people I've seen appearing as judges, both at the panel as well as the appellate body level. And I like, to some extent, the European Union system, the committee of Article 257, to choose among candidates proposed by members based on transparent criteria, which you can, of course, eventually put into question, whatever. But I don't like this idea of having behind the closed doors in rooms filled with smoke. We say in Swiss German, a Kühmarkt, that is, you exchange promises, cows essentially, to keep you get your guy, get my guy. That's no. I mean, this cannot work for. I run every year, that's my last sentence. I run every year in my dispute settlement seminar in New York. At the end of the semester, I ask people, my students, say, write down your top 10 economists, political scientists, top 10 again, top 10 trade lawyers. And then let's see how many of those guys were panelists or appellate body members. And you don't want me to give you the numbers because the numbers are close to zero. We cannot go on like that. We cannot. I mean, we have to take this exercise much more seriously. I'll say just this. I said last, but I now give one more sentence. Just look at the do typecasting of the people who are, take Europe as an example. Look at the Europeans who appear at the Court of Justice in the European Union, in Luxembourg. And look at the, take out my dear friend Ellerman, of course, everybody else who's been a candidate by the European Union. This is not good enough. And that's where I am. Thank you.
So a couple of points on these issues. One, on the dispute settlement side of things, I think one of the, and I'm not a lawyer, right? So I'm going to irritate the lawyers who are here. I think there's been excessive legalization in the WTO, right? The WTO is a trade organization. It's supposed to handle trade disputes, and that's not necessarily done. The best way to do that is not necessarily by going to court, right? So, and I think this is, of course, a general presumption for lots of disputes, but I think we can and should be doing much more to use alternative mechanisms to actually deal with conflicts, right? And I think one of the things that has been really underemphasized in the WTO discussion is that WTO members actually have been quite creative at putting those in place, right? So the notion of raising specific trade concerns in committees is an example. I think what we find in some of the more recent agreements, like the trade facilitation agreements, where the presumption is we're not immediately going to go to court, we're not going to immediately allege that you're acting in bad faith. No, we're going to say there is an implementation problem here. How do we resolve that problem? Right? So the presumption is there is a problem. So I think a lot of these things can actually be done through alternative mechanisms. That doesn't take away the need for binding enforcement and dispute settlement, but there's a lot more we could do to actually make things work more efficiently. So that's one point. On the China point, I'd like to say two things. On the one hand, you know, whether we call it unilateral or we call it exercising strategic autonomy, clearly everybody has the policy space to take a lot of actions against the type of issues that are being raised that firms are objecting to with respect to China or with respect to India or what have you. Right. So that has always been, of course, part of the equation. And I think we're going to have to use those instruments to create greater incentives to bring China to the negotiating table. So that's one point. But I think what we also need to do is I think we need to be much more clear-eyed and clear-minded to identify what actually is important to us. And part of the problem, I think, with respect to China is we have a Christmas tree problem, right? So there's lots of allegations being made. There are lots of interests who are making claims. What we don't have enough of is cool, objective analysis based on facts and where we actually identify what are the two or three things that really move the needle in terms of distorting competition on world markets, and where is what China is doing essentially what you would expect any government to do. We might not like the political system, but in effect, they're not doing anything that is all that different from what we did or continue to do. So I think we need a little bit more honesty on that front, and actually identify and take as given that we have different systems, and to focus on where are the big spillovers. That's what the WTO was created to do. And I think that's what we need to get back to doing. So for example, if you take the issue of forced technology transfer that the United States has made a huge deal out of, I don't think that is a first order issue, right? So for example. But I think what we need to do is we need to do analysis. We need to have the evidence, and the evidence simply isn't there. It's mostly a lobbying exercise. People are making claims. They're not really motivating those claims. So we need more evidence.
Yes. I mean, on the Chinese issue, just, I mean, for the first part, I mean, I cannot agree more with what Petros was saying in the beginning, that, I mean, the issue is that the rules are insufficiently adapted, and then you have to deal with an appellate body that deals with the situation, meaning an appellate body with a lot of discretion and inadapted rules. So it led to results that I think a lot of the criticism that was raised by the US is today shared by other regions, including the EU. And also, just to agree before, just to make just one comment on China with Bernard, I also agree that at some level, there has been excessive legalization of the WTO. I mean, the 400, 500 page decisions on very specific issues and interpreting things that the rules of today were never meant to interpret these kind of issues, and the way they have been interpreted, that has been leading to the whole crisis as well, I think. But to forgive, in a way, the appellate body, it's just that they are also dealing with rules that are not good for what they have to be dealing with today. And on China, I think because China's state capitalism is at the core of the challenges that we are facing today with the WTO, one issue that is also important that was, I think it was Petros that mentioned, is the fact that when the engagements and the protocol of accession of China was negotiated back in the 90s, the end of the 90s, no one was really expecting China to become that second largest economy, but most importantly, second largest economy, heavily subsidized and with a heavy governmental intervention. So that's really what brought us here. And the purpose of the whole negotiation today, and maybe having blocks formed, and that's why it's very interesting to have the US and the EU forming, hopefully more and more with the Biden administration, a coalition on certain aspects, is to really bring back with some pressure, of course, China on the table, because unless it feels a very heavy pressure, things will not be solved. And again, we do indeed have to acknowledge that we have two systems, but to the extent that their system is hurting on a competition level industries with another system, then either they follow the rules or we have separate rules applicable to them, which are not the multilateral rules. So that's the kind of thing that is at stake, and that the US together with the EU can play a major role.
Maybe to jump on just quickly on this, in the end of the day, I mean, there's two narratives we have here. And the one is really the political narrative that we see from the US. It's kind of this kind of Cold War-ish, if you want, framework of there's a competitor, the geopolitical competitor that we really have to keep in check, that has a different economic system and so on. There's also a different way of thinking about it, which is just that China is in many ways still a developing country with underdeveloped market structures, with an underdeveloped political system that just has become so big in this modern world that our system that was not built to deal with this is now under strain. And I feel sometimes we have to climb down a bit from the trees and really address the issues and prioritize the issues, as you were saying. It will be difficult to find a balance between, on the one hand, we need pressure against China for something to change, but on the other hand, we will not get anywhere if we just treat China as an enemy and basically play it up as this kind of systemic struggle. In the end of the day, when we want to trade with China, and I think everyone still wants to do that, we need to kind of get them into the system back again. And we need to find solutions that are within the system instead of really just this unilateral actions that we've seen over the last years.
You see, I don't want to be misunderstood. I will actually, if you look at the book we did with Andrei, we say clearly we condemn unilateral policies against China. We say that's why the subtitle of the book is Why Multilateralism Matters. But there are some things we simply should not close our eyes to. If you have a state-owned enterprise in Europe, it has to observe European competition law. Now, there are hundreds of cases, and Dr. Diaz, who is a lawyer, should know much better than me, from Corbeau to you name it, which pose limits on the way state-owned enterprises function and how they cannot undo the market structure and competition within the relevant product market. But when you talk state-owned enterprises in China, all these things are missing. Every paper I have seen on enforcement of competition law in China says industrial policy. I haven't seen one paper, except for papers by some super partisans, but then they cite no empirical evidence, that goes the other way. Now, this, I'm not saying that this is a problem within the current, which can be solved within the current legal framework. No, there's nothing like world competition law, but it is a problem. Now, maybe some people thought SOEs in China would eventually change over the years, but they didn't. We see the opposite, actually, as of 2003 with SASAC and so on. Now, but irrelevant if it is legitimate or legitimate expectations, there is an issue. And the question is, what do about it? What we say is, solve it multilaterally, not bilaterally. But it is not that we can accommodate everybody in the WTO, irrespective of regime. It doesn't work this way.
Because you mentioned that we have to, I mean, to face the fact that China is a developing country. Yes, on certain areas and on certain aspects, but on the issues there are the blocking issues today, one of them at least on this governmental interventions, they are very much comparable to developed countries. And if I can just give one example, I'll not name it, but we know a number of industries where in a few months' time, because it is a governmental policy of China to invest on the strategic sector, the building plants with the capacity that surpassed world capacity in a matter of 1-2 years. And then you see industries in some other countries that were traditional industries just shutting down and it's over. And that's the kind of situation we face. So when we hear China saying that on those sectors, they are a developing country, and when we see what's happening in the market, and they're doing that not because they're more effective, it's just because they have a lot of state intervention and a lot of support from the state. So it's very hard to say, yes, I understand you're a developing country, and you will be allowed to apply rules differently because it just hurts the industries elsewhere.
If I may just respond to that, I think if I say it's a developing country, what I mean that it's not really, as you're saying very correctly, that it is, that we should give it special rights. It's more in the sense of what's our expectations. And I think might see the similar problems with other developing countries, the way they grow. It's just the way, basically, it's in many ways, as you say, we don't have a competition law. It's not super clear to me that these state-owned enterprises, which are really in the core of the industrial policy, are necessary to advantage of the Chinese economies. There's many statistics showing that they are much less productive than the private sector. And these are, it's wrong to reflect them as growing pains from China. I think it's just the fact that a country of this system in this stage of development of this size is really doesn't fit into the framework that we have.
For how much this is really an interesting discussion, of course, and super linked to the WTO reform conversation, we don't have that much time. And I would still like to have at least one question from our audience. I see that Amer has been patiently waiting for us.
Thank you very much, Giuseppe, and thank you everyone for an amazing session. I'm a Middle East economy researcher, so by no means I'm an expert on trade, and therefore maybe I might detract a bit from the technical part and go into something that has been on my mind for quite a bit of time since the pandemic has started, which is, you know, with restrictions and with bubbles and etc., I think regional trade is more and more on the agenda. I'm quite aware that it's a long-term fantasy and probably will not happen in the way that, you know, some people imagine it will happen, but there's clearly higher signs that regional trade will become more and more relevant into the future, especially with, like Petros mentioned earlier, with some regional trade agreements like the TPP in Asia. So do you think this trend of regional trade will actually further sideline the WTO, or do you think maybe the WTO can actually play an active role in promoting such trade agreements that are based on regional exchange, etc.? Thank you.
I do agree, and I strongly believe that, yes, one of the way forward in the short term, at least, is that we'll see increasingly more bilateral or regional agreements. And if I can take a couple of examples, I mean, I think we'll see more and more agreements like the CETA agreement, the USMCA, which are agreements that open trade, but that also at the same time contain some labor and environmental provisions. There are provisions that are more delicate to be negotiated, as it was mentioned here earlier, at the WTO level with everyone on the table. So we see more and more regional agreements and dealing with modern issues, if I can call it that way, that you cannot deal with yet with everyone on the table. And also the way forward, and that's a good one for the WTO, I guess, it's that we are seeing more and more plurilateral agreements as well between the like-minded countries, like the one we have with public procurements. Because in those kind of agreements, it remains within the framework of the WTO. It is important because the debate remains at this very broad level. Those who agree today already put themselves together on the table, and we try to attract the other ones later when they're ready.
Thank you, Anna. And I would have to close the conversation, but before closing, I just would like to ask if you have a last, perhaps really one sentence for what to expect and look forward in the next months, let's say, really in the short term, because it seems that a lot of things are happening in the short term, meaning between now and the end of the year.
I could say go on vacation and don't worry at all about it. Nothing will happen in the next month. We are miles away from concluding fisheries and miles away from concluding anything. I'm not that optimistic about the near future.
That's very clear. Thank you, Petros. Anna?
I don't see anything moving fast on what really matters after the WTO, but that's not bad news in itself, in the sense that, yes, it would be better, but there are other good alternatives that are taking place, and that I believe with time will, which it's not unilateral again, it's bilateral, plurilateral, but that will foster that willingness, political willingness to get to the table at some point again at the WTO.
Thank you. And Niklas?
I think in the end, the big question for this year seemed to me really what the kind of new relationship between the EU and US will be. And this will probably not really manifest itself that much into action. I mean, we have seen some action. We now have a resolution of the Boeing Airbus dispute, or at least a temporary resolution. But it's more in the sense of building a common vision. I think there's much more engagement now. There's more of on the US side, much more of a idea of building a common approach. And I think this might change the policy in Europe, might change the stance in US a bit, if there's a much more dialogue now. And that's probably what I would look out for the next year, not for specific results, but more really about what would be what would be the symbolic relationship, how will the language change over the year.
Thank you. And this brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. I would like to remind you that our podcast has a club on Clubhouse with the same name, and I invite you to follow it and participate to our conversations here. You will find in the show notes the link to the latest issue of the Revue Open de Droit, with the article about the WTO reform, which we have discussed in this conversation. Also, don't forget that you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Thanks so much, Anna, Bernard, Petros, Niklas, Vasile, Amer, and all the other listeners that joined the conversation for this time on our room on Clubhouse. Until next time, bye-bye.